It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Communities around the U.S. and countries around the world are reconsidering their policies on addictive drugs. Here in the U.S., there's been a lot of attention lately to a law in Oregon from 2021. It's called Measure 110. It decriminalized possession of small amounts of all drugs, changing the punishment to a fine. Only those with larger quantities of drugs are prosecuted. Oregon has some of the highest rates of substance abuse in the nation, according to federal surveys, and access to treatment hasn't kept pace. There's been backlash against the measure in Oregon as people cite incidents of public drug use in Portland and elsewhere and an increase in overdose deaths. But it can be hard to sort out the effects of decriminalization as overdose deaths went up in communities all over the country, not just Oregon. We're taking a look at the only state in the country to decriminalize all drugs and what lessons we might be able to take from that policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on decriminalizing drug use and focusing on treatment instead? Do you think something like that would work in Wisconsin? Do you want to see some drugs decriminalized, not others? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Alex Kreit is the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy and an assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. Alex, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this Measure 110 in the state of Oregon? What does it do? What were the intentions behind it?
Yeah, so this was passed through a ballot measure in 2020. And the idea really was to take, you know, a true public health approach, to attempt to take a true public health approach to substance use and addiction, substance use disorder. And it was modeled after similar measures in other countries, including most notably in Portugal. And what it does, it basically decriminalizes a possession of personal use amounts of all previously illegal drugs. And so if you have a personal use amount of drugs in Oregon, that is not a criminal offense any longer. Instead, it's kind of like an infraction type of level thing where you would get a $100 traffic ticket type of fine, and that traffic ticket can be waived if the person who receives it calls a treatment referral number and agrees to participate in a treatment needs assessment. Now, of course, that's just for smaller personal use amounts. Possession of non-personal use amounts is a misdemeanor. And then, of course, the drug sales, manufacture, those kinds of offenses remain, you know, as they had been.
There's been backlash in the media and elsewhere this year, people pointing toward complaints about public drug use, rising rates of addiction, concerns about overdose deaths. That could be because of decriminalization, but similar things are happening in other states around the country. How do you try to tease out what this decriminalization measure has actually done over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think it really is still too early to know and try to untangle what the overall effect of Measure 110, and that's the number of that ballot measure, has been in Oregon. Because and it's been a little unfortunate to see in the past couple of weeks or so some news stories and kind of, I think, trying to maybe politicize it a bit or trying to jump to early conclusions, because, you know, there have been certainly an increase in overdose deaths in Oregon since 2019, but that's true nationwide. I think there's been something like a 94% increase across the country of overdose deaths between 2019 and 2021. And Oregon still has a lower overdose death rate than the national average. I think theirs is like 25 per 100,000, and the national average is 34 per 100,000. So, you know, it's a situation where you could point to, do a profile of Portland and point to a lot of problems that have been increasing there in the past couple of years around homelessness, disorderly behavior, overdose deaths. But that same profile could be written about a number of other cities, you know, unfortunately, in the United States. I'm recalling the New York Times had a profile of Phoenix, Arizona, in a homelessness encampment there a few months back that painted a kind of similar picture to some of the profiles of Portland. So it's really difficult to say. I mean, we do know, certainly with respect to 110, some measurables. We know that arrests for possession have fallen substantially. I think it was by 83% in 2021. We know that that certainly saves a degree of money. I believe it was estimated that an arrest for possession in Oregon cost about $15,000 or so prior to that ballot measure. So every arrest you don't make is some money saved. We do know for sure that the state is has increased its investment and its funding of harm reduction services and, to a degree, treatment services. And we know that there has been some increase in people receiving treatment services in Oregon. But again, we do also know there's been a rise in overdose deaths. There's certainly been an increase in homelessness in Portland and public reports of public use, incidents of public use. So, you know, I think we have, you know, what to my mind is a little bit of an unclear situation about what the overall impact of 110 is on the circumstance in Oregon.
Talking to Alex Kreit with the Chase Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University, looking at decriminalization of drugs, an experiment going on right now in the state of Oregon and in countries like Portugal. What lessons can we learn? What can't we learn? Want to know what you think or what questions you have at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alex, you mentioned a couple phrases there that I wanted to dig more into. One part of this ballot measure, I was hoping to replace some of that criminal justice spending with harm reduction investment. What do we mean when we talk about harm reduction as a public policy?
Yeah, so, you know, harm reduction measures are measures that, you know, really kind of, it's in the name, you know, aiming to reduce the harms associated with substance use. So there would be things like expanding access to the overdose reversal drug naloxone for opioid overdose deaths, expanding access to drug checking, you know, equipment and drug checking availability for people. For example, drug checking would allow somebody, if they have purchased, you know, what they think is cocaine, to check that to make sure that it's not tainted with fentanyl, because a lot of the overdose deaths that are occurring out there are from people who are taking what they think, you know, they purchased and they think that it's cocaine and it's actually tainted and laced with fentanyl. You get, you know, certainly overdose deaths occurring from that sort of thing. So harm reduction services are those kinds of measures that are not directly attacking or aiming to address treatment needs. Now, Measure 110 also does expand funding for treatment, but the expansion for harm reduction measures are for those kinds of things, to try to reduce the harms associated with substance use, most notably and most urgently, of course, overdose deaths.
And then on the treatment side of things, as you mentioned, the ballot measure increased funding for treatment, at least some. There's a concern, and again, this is a concern, I think, around the country, that there still isn't enough treatment available for people seeking to end addictions.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, one of the real difficulties with implementation in Oregon, I think, has really been around the fact that Oregon, before this ballot measure, was consistently among the lowest in treatment availability in the country, as far as in comparison to other states, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. And so, you know, Oregon was starting at a starting point of very low treatment availability. And this ballot measure, one of the aims of it is to try to increase that treatment availability. I think it's certainly done that to a degree, but I think there's no question that it's far below where it needs to be. And there's a lot of room for debate about the degree to which this is something where, you know, there's flaws maybe in the ballot measure in its contemplation of the degree of funding or the allocations of funding. But there's also, a reality that ramping up real comprehensive treatment is something that takes a lot more time and money to do than other kinds of public health measures, especially like harm reduction kinds of measures. If you want to increase access to drug checking, for example, you can purchase, you know, the drug checking strips. It's relatively easy and lower cost or lower investment to make that purchase, make those available. When you're talking about treatment, you know, especially residential treatment, you have to build the physical place or rent the physical place, set that place up. You have to hire staff on an ongoing basis. It's something that, you know, you can't kind of just snap a finger, even with money, and overnight you immediately ramp up that treatment capacity. So I think that is one of the things that, especially in the next, you know, year or two, is going to be critical to see, is how much is the money that is getting invested, you know, how much is that going to actually come to fruition for expansion of treatment capacity? Because that is something that, you know, it is takes a lot longer to ramp up than other kinds of public health measures that are being funded by this ballot measure.
We're talking about Oregon's decriminalization of all drugs as it enters its third year, and lessons that other states, maybe even Wisconsin, could learn. Our guest is Alex Kreit, director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy and assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What solutions would you like to see for the problems of addiction and overdose deaths? Do you think that prosecuting people for drug use cuts down on drug use? If not, what would you like to see us do instead? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about drug decriminalization with Alex Kreit, director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy and assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. This ballot measure a couple years back in Oregon decriminalized all drugs. What do you want to know about the policy, the impact it's had? What do you think of the idea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is on the line in Wisconsin. Dan, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Hey, I wanted to bring up a few different things. I just happened to be eating lunch and listening to what's going on today. And, you know, it's always a curiosity to me to what's going on right now about the Oregon thing. Here's a little insight. Whenever you make anything illegal, I think that you create a commodity that people are going to buy no matter what. And whether it's drugs or even prostitution, I know it sounds radical, but it's true. And when you have this kind of thing criminalized, I don't think the people are going to be feeling that they're in a safe position if they're on drugs or if they're a prostitution to come forward for any kind of help, because with it being criminalized, they're frightened, especially, let's say, it's an illegal immigrant person that's already confused about being here. That person won't come forward because it's decriminalized, and possibly the law might be worse than what the actual being on the drugs or being in the prostitution ring might be.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Alex, I think that's one of the core arguments about whether or not to decriminalize. We'll stick with drugs in particular. The idea that the harm of criminalization could rival, maybe even outweigh, the harm of the substance itself. What do you think of Dan's point?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that goes to one of the reasons that, you know, Measure 110, the advocates behind that, the sort of rationale for the ballot measure, and, you know, Portugal's law, which, you know, Measure 110 was based on, that was enacted in 2001. Part of the philosophy behind that was that criminalization keeps people of use, specifically keeps users more in the shadows, deters people from getting treatment, makes them scared to come forward and admit that they need treatment. And certainly Portugal, you know, had a good deal of success with their decriminalization policy, with reductions in overdose deaths, reductions in new cases of HIV among drug injectors. And so, you know, that was the thinking behind, you know, Measure 110. And I think it is also the case with respect to thinking about sort of criminalization and whether criminalizing use, you know, quote unquote, works. We've got a long sort of history of criminalizing drug possession and not really any data suggesting that drug criminalization or criminalizing simple possession has an effect in a reduction in substance use disorder and problems with addiction and abuse. And so that was the thinking behind Measure 110. Now, of course, you know, so to date, Oregon hasn't seen the kinds of successes that Portugal did in its first decade of decriminalization. On the other hand, the decriminalization in Oregon took place at a time when the entire United States is going through this epidemic of substance use disorder and overdose death. And so, you know, it's that makes it, I think, difficult to measure what the effect might be with Measure 110. And I think there's a, you know, fair debate to be had. And I think it's very worthy of study to look at Measure 110 and say, you know, is this a situation where there are differences between that Measure 110 in Portugal that lead to there being, having been at least so far, less success? Are there areas where it can be tweaked? Or is it a situation where, you know, even though things aren't going great in Oregon, maybe they're better than they would have been in the absence of Measure 110? I think it's kind of an open question at this point.
Dan, thanks for the call. We'll go to Chris now in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So as I am very much in support of this, this measure in Portland, when we look at this from a standpoint of variables in have legislated this problem, we have a lot of data to draw from, roughly 100 years of trying to legislate this problem. What type of timeline do you think is really adequate to look at it, this experiment in Portland and say
Chris,
that...
I got you. Your phone line's breaking up, but I think we get the point. Alex, Chris wondering, how long will it take before we have enough good, solid data on a decriminalization measure like that in Oregon to know what impact it's having?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly we're talking, you know, at least a few years before you're probably going to get some of the kinds of robust studies that could compare outcomes in Oregon, you know, in general, and Portland in particular, to other states, other cities. I do think, you know, as things stand currently, you know, I think the data is telling us and the results are telling us that, you know, for example, overdose deaths have increased in Oregon, but not out of the norm to what's gone on across the country. And so I think, you know, it's certainly not a case where you can, and I've seen some news articles recently kind of paint pictures of Portland and say, you know, there's all these terrible things happening because of Measure 110. But again, these kinds of things, unfortunately, particularly with respect to drug overdoses, are happening nationwide. And so you could go to, you know, any city, any state in the country, and you could paint the picture, you know, terribly. And it's a terrible, awful thing, but you can paint the picture anywhere in the country of a rise in overdose deaths. And so it's, you know, we know that is the unfortunate reality. We also do know that in Oregon, there has been increases in funding for harm reduction services for treatment as a result of Measure 110. What we, you know, are probably not going to know for a few years is going to be, you know, how we can compare the situation in Oregon to what's gone on in other states, you know, and have really robust studies that would attempt to try to measure the impact of Measure 110.
Talking to Alex Kreid, who researches addiction law and policy about a decriminalization of drugs in Oregon and elsewhere around the world. David joins us now in Grand Marsh. David, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, really like the topic. Unfortunately, this topic strikes really close to home in my family. And I just think that this country needs to just get away from, you know, the incarceration of people and redeveloping and redistributing, you know, the economics of it to get people the assistance they need to, you know, get back on track and to get back into society and to contribute. And I really think that we're headed in the right direction when we have these kinds of conversations.
David, thanks a lot for the call. David mentions the economics of this, Alex, and I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, how in a lot of communities where housing costs are very high, homelessness, in part because of that, is going up. How much is our drug and addiction problem tangled up with homelessness in a lot of our communities?
I think that there's an element to that, and I think there's also sort of more broadly an element to a lack of healthcare access, a lack of access to social services. I mean, if we compare U.S. Overdose rates and substance use disorder issues with sort of peer countries in the European Union, you know, the United States has a strikingly worse, you know, is it just strikingly worse? I think, you know, in Portugal, there was roughly 7 per million residents of an overdose death rate in 2021. In the United States, it was 321 per million, which is obviously significantly more than 7 per million. And so, you know, I think that that really does go back to kind of the philosophy behind Measure 110 of we want to take money that we're currently spending on incarceration and reinvest that money, and not just incarceration, but arrest enforcement, reinvest that money in access to treatment and harm reduction services. But I think that one of the, you know, criticisms of 110 might be there needs to be more investment, you know, and I don't know to what extent that would necessarily be something that is a problem with Measure 110 specifically versus a criticism of how we approach these issues in general. One thing I do think, though, that is, you know, well worth keeping in mind, while I think the jury is still out on what the impact of Measure 110 is, I think we do have a lot of good data and history. We've had a long history of criminalizing substance use and criminalizing simple possession, and we really don't have data showing that that succeeds in addressing substance use disorder. So whether 110 specifically has, you know, succeeds, what its impact is, I do think we have a lot of data that tells us criminalizing use has not worked. And so we can see why Oregon voters, you know, explored and supported this alternative in 2010. We'll see, you know, I think in the coming years, more data on what the results are of it.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Alex Kreit, director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy, assistant professor at the Northern Kentucky University School of Law. He talked to us about Oregon's Measure 110, which decriminalized all drugs a couple years back. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's Food Friday. Summer is coming to an end. With it, the days of garden fresh fruits and vegetables. But if you want to keep eating delicious quality produce year round, might be time to try out canning, pickling, and preserving. Our next guest got national attention a couple years back for dominating a county fair in Appalachia with her canned corn, canned tomatoes, pickled peppers, sauerkraut relish, spaghetti sauce, and jelly and jam, plus cookies and quilts. She has a new cookbook out, and she's here with some inspiration and advice for us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy canning and pickling? What are your favorite things to get into a jar? Do you have favorite recipes or advice to share? Do you remember a time when preserving produce wasn't just a hobby, but a necessity? Or are you just getting into it? Maybe you're canning something this weekend and you have some questions for our guest. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Skeens is the author of Blue Ribbon Kitchen, Recipes and Tips from America's Favorite County Fair Champion. Came out a couple months back. She's won over, did I have this right, 1,400 ribbons at fairs and cooking competitions over the last decade. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
Now, it's a busy season for you right now. I think you've got some fair season. You got a lot of great produce coming out there in Virginia like we do. What projects do you have going over the weekend? What are you putting in jars?
Well, I'm getting ready to put some stuff in the Russell County Fair Sunday. I have made dill pickles, bread and butter pickles, chow chow, corn relish, sauerkraut, 5 kinds of jam. I've made a new jam the other day, and you have to use bourbon, jalapeno peppers, and blackberries in it. I've never made it, and it's pretty hot.
That sounds fantastic. Is this something you invented on your own?
My youngest daughter found it on the phone. She said, Mom, you always want to try new recipes. How about trying this one? So her husband loves hot peppers. So I tried it, and it's actually pretty good.
Now, you wrote something in the book that surprised me. Now, you're winning blue ribbons all over the place, but you say, you know, earlier in your adult life when you got married, you were not a good cook. I think you said you were a bad cook. How bad was it?
It's pretty bad. My mother was a wonderful cook, but she'd always have the cooking done when I'd get home from school or when I get out of bed every morning, you know. But I learned out of necessity. I right off had two kids right away. I was 16, and I said, if I'm going to have to feed them, and my husband had to eat, so I learned to cook. And some was passed down, and some I learned on my own. But I'm a pretty good cook now.
Oh, I think you got the ribbons to back up that statement too. Now, when did you start? What were your first steps when it came to pickling and canning? What were your first experiments?
Well, the first things I started doing, my mother-in-law lived beside him at the time, and she taught me how to make kraut and how to make jelly and some stuff, and some I just learned on my own. My best advice to anybody starting out, if you don't have a grandmother or a mother or someone you know to help you, you can buy the ball canning book at like Rural King or Walmart, anywhere it sells canning supplies, and that book will tell you how to can or freeze anything that you can think of. And it's wonderful. A lot of my recipes comes out of there.
What if somebody's thinking, yeah, I want a can, I've never done it. What do you recommend their first experiment should be? Like what are some of the easier things to can?
I think jelly or jams are the easiest to start out with. Really, I do. And then after that, pretty much green beans and peaches and things, tomatoes and things are fairly easy. They're just a lot of work getting them prepared. But I would say start out with just some jam. Seriously.
Now, if we want to go on, you know, we want to can our tomatoes and our peppers and our corn and stuff like that, what are the basic pieces of gear we have to have on hand?
Well, you have to have a canner. And some people use pressure canners. I like the old-fashioned canner that you cook on the stove. And you have to have cannon jars. Make sure you use a ball cannon jars, because you can't use those mayonnaise jars. If you use them, when they get that heat in them, they'll break and you'll ruin your stuff. Make sure you have good seals and lids to go on them. And all your stuff I always make a list of what all I need when I'm going to make something, and I have it ready when I get started doing it.
We're talking to Linda Skeens on this edition of Food Friday. She has won many, many blue ribbons at county fairs. We're talking about canning and preserving, giving some ideas from her new book, Blue Ribbon Kitchen, Recipes and Tips from America's Favorite County Fair Champion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe you got something in the works for this weekend. Tell us about it at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda, you write in the book, you're worried that canning is kind of a dying art. You're really hoping that younger generations get into it. Why is that?
Well, I just think a lot of people, young people now, I know with the necessity of both parents a lot of times working, they eat out a lot, and it's just easier to go to the store and buy stuff. But my mom and dad had seven kids, and my mom canned to feed us. That fed us during the winter because you couldn't run to the grocery store every time you turned around. And she would can 100 to 200 cans of stuff, and it kept us all fed during the winter. So I just kind of got into that mode. I started making jams and stuff when my daughter and my oldest son was just little. And I found out when you can your own stuff, you know what ingredients is in it. There's nothing in it that you don't know what it is. You know what you're putting in there. Like you have your green beans, your salt, and your water. That's all's in them. And that I feel good about that because you know what you're feeding your family that way.
Now, you mentioned earlier your chow chow. And one of our producers here asked, what is chow chow? So can you tell us, what is chow chow? What goes into it?
Okay, that's something my mama, that's her recipe. Most people like chow chow. Do you know what soup beans is?
Soup beans.
Pinto beans.
Oh, pinto beans. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, cooked. Chow chow is excellent with that and cornbread, or some people actually like it on hot dogs. But what goes into it? Red, yellow, green peppers, sweet onions, cabbage. Then you have your vinegar and your spices and your sugar. And it's just like a relish, really. But it's better than any relish you get in a store. And then my mama added some banana peppers to it to give it a little zing, and I've always put banana peppers in mine.
I'm looking at the picture. This looks beautiful, the chow chow in your book. Now, when you're putting jars in for the county fair, like how important is, you know, the visual, how it looks, as opposed to just, you know, how it tastes?
Okay, they judge how your stuff looks, but also all your canning stuff has to be like a quarter or a half inch to the top of the jar. Say if you fill a jar of peaches and it's not all the way full to the top, they take off points for that. Your jars have to be sealed, no rust on the lids. They have to be in regular canning jars and has to be processed right. If it doesn't, and they judge your jams if it sets good, you know, if it's like a solid jam, if it's real watery and like runny, you know, they judge on all that stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about jam a little bit. What do we do to make sure our jam doesn't get too runny? Because even if I'm not putting in the fare, I don't want, you know, juice on my sandwich. I want jam.
Use sure gel. That's why they call it sure gel. It's a fruit pectin. I've been using it for 40 years. If you put that in there with your sugar and your fruit, it always gels. It always sets, and I've never had any that didn't.
Now, Linda, do you garden yourself? Are you actually canning stuff out of your own garden this time of year?
No, actually, we have this place about a mile, about an hour and a half from where we live. And it's a huge farm. They sell green beans, corn, tomatoes, cabbage, squash, anything that you can want to can. And also my brother-in-law has made 5 trips out of his garden to my house. He's brought zucchini, squash, tomatoes, peppers, hot peppers, green tomatoes. I have friends, they know that I can, and they will bring, Kathy Brock came down there one day with 2 huge heads of cabbage, my daughter that her neighbor would give her. She brought me tomatoes. People donate stuff to me, and then I buy the rest of it. But we have farmers markets, too.
Yeah, I used to, I just do fridge pickles now and fridge relishes, but I used to can. And what I do is I'd go to the farmer's market, and I'd talk to farmers and say, hey, next week, bring those bruised tomatoes, you know, the stuff that doesn't look pretty. I'd buy it cheap and then can all of that. That's a good way to use the stuff that, you know, you wouldn't slice up and put on a salad. Have you found canning to be a good way to use the ugly produce, they call it?
Well, Man's Farm, the one I told you about, they have special boxes of tomatoes, like there's a box, and they're overripe. They're ready for, they're great for salsa or for canning, but they're not good that you'd eat on your table. And I get those to do my canning with and make my salsa and canned tomatoes with. And they have special ones for that.
We're talking to Linda Skeens, author of the book Blue Ribbon Kitchen, Recipes and Tips from America's Favorite County Fair Champion. She's giving us advice on how to can and pickle and preserve our favorite foods safely and deliciously. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. I guess we don't can and preserve in Wisconsin anymore, but everybody would be calling in. This is the time of year. Call in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite pickled foods? Any unusual ones? How did you learn to can or preserve, maybe make a jam? What questions do you have for our guest? She's done just about all of it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Linda Skeens, author of Blue Ribbon Kitchen, Recipes and Tips from America's Favorite County Fair Champion. We're talking with her about canning, pickling, and preserving our favorite foods to enjoy year-round. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your stories, maybe your project for the next couple of weeks if you can. If you need some advice, some inspiration, Linda's got it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Debbie is with us in Knife River, Minnesota. Debbie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I want to know what to do or how to deal with these choke cherries. I've got a whole sink full of choke cherries here, and I need to know how to efficiently make them into juice because they're a real pain to deal with.
And tell us about choke cherries. That's not a household word, Debbie.
Okay, so choke cherries are these little tiny quarter-inch berries that are cherries that grow on wild trees. They're really good for you, but they are about 90% pit. And they're and I have made them into jelly before. I've made them into juice, but the biggest hang-up is trying to get enough juice off of these things. You have to pick. I picked 20 pounds last year, and probably only got a few quarts. It's just a lot of work. I'm just wondering if there is a more efficient way to deal with them.
Debbie, thanks for the call. Now, I don't know if do you have these choke cherries in your neck of the woods, Linda?
No, never heard of them, but we do have little red cherries on trees. But I agree with her. I don't know of a way that they're easy to get out, those pits out. And the thing of it is, there's not much left when you get the pit out. So I'm on that one. She's got me stumped. I would have no idea. I know I have set and pitted cherries, like she said, for hours and maybe just get a little bit out of them. So I don't know.
Debbie, thanks for the call. I guess just hard labor on that one. Carol joins us in Oconomowoc. Carol, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Carol?
I wanted to ask about pickling hard-boiled eggs. I have home chickens, and I'd like to make pickled hard-boiled eggs. I've never done it before. And I wouldn't mind if they were a little spicy. Just wondering if that's something there's some tips or tricks for.
Carol, thanks for calling. Lynn, this is something we do in Wisconsin. You can get these at some of the old bars. You got pickled eggs up on the counter. Is this a Virginia tradition too?
Well, I don't do pickled eggs because my husband, he wouldn't like them. But now my son-in-law has done them. And I'm not sure how. I know he uses vinegar in them. And he uses a little bit of sugar, but that's all I can tell you. He pickles bologna too, like you do the eggs. But I've never done that because my husband's not he's not crazy about pickle stuff. But she probably could go on her phone. Kathy, my daughter Kathy, a lot of times when we're looking for something that we don't know, we go on the phone and ask it, and it'll tell you how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck finding that egg recipe. Now, something else we like here in Wisconsin, Linda, I know you've won awards for, is sauerkraut. And I remember my grandparents, my Polish grandparents, making sauerkraut in their kitchen. What's your secret to your award-winning sauerkraut?
My mother-in-law just told me how to do it. She told me how to shred it, put it in the jar, and the solution to put over it with the salt and vinegar and water solution. I put it in those jars and pickle it, and it always turns out perfect. And now my mother used to take they had these big things called crocks, and they would put the kraut down in there and put like cheesecloth over it and let it pickle and then put it in the jars. But I don't have one of those, so I just do them in the jars.
That was the way my grandparents did it. You got to have a certain tolerance for the smell when you got them in the crock in the house.
Yeah.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about canning, pickling, and preserving with Linda Skeens. Her new book is Blue Ribbon Kitchen, Recipes and Tips from America's Favorite County Fair Champion. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Gretchen is with us in northern Wisconsin. Gretchen, hi.
Hi. I learned how to can by watching some YouTube videos. Some university extension offices had classes online, and I watched some people that on YouTube that did it. And so I started, like she said, with jams and jellies, and then just went from there to meats and different produce, because I found out that I could buy these things from the farmer's market or from the grocery store when they had very good sales. And I can chicken and I can sweet potatoes and my favorite classic tomato soup and on and on and on. It's just fun.
Gretchen, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And Linda, Gretchen, I think, brings us back to one of the main points of canning. It's taking that thing that's there in abundance at one point in the year and then stretching it out through the rest of the year. How much fun is it for you? Is it to, you know, take that thing you canned now and then middle of winter, you're still eating something that tastes, you know, fresh and delicious?
It is good. Very good.
Yeah. What do you have things, Linda, that you look forward to? Like, I'm canning them now and I know I'm going to love it when I eat it in 3-4 months.
Jelly, mostly. Mm-hmm. But I like green beans too, like at Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners. Those fresh green beans you can't be beat.
All right.
They're good.
Thanks a lot for that call, Gretchen, and happy canning to you. Gary joins us now in Sheboygan. Gary, hi.
Hey, I've got a question. You know, years ago, we up in northern Wisconsin, there was a woman up there that every time we'd have a wedding up there, she would can venison for us for the weddings. And I'll tell you, that it was better than roast beef. And she passed away now, and never got a recipe from her for canning that. It was dry. It was kind of real dry in the bottle. There would be some gravy in there, but you had to put a little juice in with it or whatever. But God darn, people that didn't like to eat venison never knew that they were eating it.
Gary, thanks a lot for calling. Linda, we're giving you all of our favorite Wisconsin area specialties. Have you worked with canned meat at all? I know you said you had a relative who did canned bologna, but any other canned meat tips out there?
I've canned some chicken breast one time, went to the cannery. They have a cannery over from where I live, and a friend of mine bought some chicken breast that was on sale. We got a really good deal, and we packed it in the metal cans with the juice and canned it. And it's really good, like when you open it up in the winter, you know, to make like chicken salad or stuff. But now I met a man at the Virginia Kentucky Fair this year that he bought my cookbook, and he is a canner. He said he cans venison, he cans squirrel meat. I could not believe him. He said his grandmother, him and all four of his brothers, had a can so that they wouldn't starve. She said she wanted them to grow up and know how to fix food and be able to eat it. So I was amazed at talking to him.
Thanks for calling in, Gary. Nancy is with us now in central Wisconsin. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment. I learned to can from my mother, and I kind of continued that tradition. I do all my own fruits and vegetables, jams, and I can meats as well. I've always canned venison, like you guys were talking about, which is super simple to do. And salmon as well. Like venison and salmon, it's just a matter of packing it in like wide mouth pint jars, and you pressure cook it for 90 minutes. You don't add any water. You know, add your spices if you want. You add, you know, onion if you want. But that's really all there is to it. As long as you know how to operate a canning pressure cooker, you're good to go.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Linda, Nancy mentioned learning from her mom. Now, have you passed down your canning secrets to your kids and grandkids at this point?
The ones that want to is interested, yes. That's why I wanted to really do a cookbook. It's like something I could leave them, and they'll always have a part of me in that book because I wrote the poems in it. It's got my life story plus my favorite recipes. So that's something I had always wanted to do. And you were talking about canning a while ago. I had an experience back last year. They said that at the place I was at, they called it jarring. And I said, well, yes, you do put it in a jar, but if you don't cook it properly and process it, it's no good. You might as well throw it out.
And Linda,
I said, we call it canning from where I come from.
Oh, me too. We definitely do too. Linda, just in our last few moments, something I love about the book, the canning parts and the other parts, you love cooking. It's something that's gotten you through tough times. Can you just share, just tell us a little bit about how much joy you get from all forms of cooking?
Well, someone asked me a while back, they said, why is your chocolate chip cookies the winner? I said, I put a lot of love in it. That's all I can think. I enjoy cooking for my family. Like today, we've been cooking for the fair. We made homemade yeast rolls that were like big as a saucer, probably. Well, a coffee cup, anyway. We've made homemade cinnamon rolls. We've made pound cake. We've made four kinds of fudge. I made a fudge that's freeze-dried strawberries and freeze-dried blueberries in a white fudge to enter in the fair. We've made all kinds of stuff, and I just love doing stuff like that. I enjoy it.
Linda, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me. And I hope I was sorry I couldn't be a help, but my husband's not a deer hunter, so I've never canned anything like that.
That's okay. That's okay. That's Linda Skeeds, author of Blue Ribbon Kitchen, Recipes and Tips from America's Favorite County Fair Champion. Talk to her about canning, pickling, preserving our favorite produce to enjoy year round. You can keep sharing your canning favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kett, as Wisconsin deals with new concerns about water pollution, look back at efforts to get PCB pollution out of the Fox River. That's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I almost missed a major milestone in the history of sound. August marked the 60th anniversary of the release of the consumer audio cassette tape. Yeah, those cassettes aren't as popular now, but they were a routine part of life for music and radio for decades. The Philips company released their audio cassettes and recording and playback devices in August of 1963. There had been magnetic audio tape recording before that. This was the first major consumer product. Cassettes were never the best quality for music, or anything, but I have fond memories of listening to cheap cassettes, winding the tape back in with a pencil, making mixtapes for myself or others. I started with listening to my dad's collection. I remember one of the first cassettes that was mine in particular. It's from the first album by The Clash. I still can't really make out the words. This is Central Time. Time the pressure of the glass in a rock up.